Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. Mary has abandoned us yet again, but you won't be stuck with just the two of us, as a friend of the podcast, Rachel McDaniel, is here to fill the Canadian void. So on Tuesday, Mets GM Sandy Alderson announced that he was stepping away from the team to concentrate on his health, stating that he did not expect to return to the team due to both his cancer diagnosis and the team's poor performance. We wish Sandy well. Now for our main topics. Since we were recording this on July 1st, aka Canada Day, we're going to run through some of the best Canadian baseball players and tidbits in MLB history. We would be remiss to begin with any player other than Joey Votto. He began the season rather slowly for him, but has once again become the NL leader in OBP and second only to Mike Trout across Major League Baseball. Votto is renowned for, among other things, his sheer consistency, his plate discipline, his impressive aversion to hitting pop flies. What are some of the best Joey Votto stats?
Okay, so last season, with strikeout rates skyrocketing throughout baseball, Votto's personal K rate actually declined by 6% from the prior season, while his walk rate bumped up 3%. So he had 134 walks last year versus only 83 strikeouts. That's 51 more walks than strikeouts, which in this day and age is just unheard of. Like, you know, that's like Ted Williams stuff, but it was happening in 2017. So, yeah, that's one of my favorite Joey Votto stats.
And Votto also has a career infield fly rate of only 1.1%, which is the lowest of all time among players with a minimum of 1,500 plate appearances. Like, he just never, ever pops out, which is amazing. He's had two seasons so far in which he didn't hit a single pop-up, and he hasn't hit one yet this season. So we could be seeing another one there. That's wild. He's so good.
It's crazy. Like, it's an event when Joey Votto actually does hit a pop-up because it's so unusual.
And he has, like, his eye at the plate is just absolutely unheard of, which is why he has been getting thrown out in the first inning of games recently.
Joey, he's a character, too. That's the other great thing about him. Like, we can talk about the numbers all that we want, but he's just... He's got such a personality, you know?
He's got that look on his face. He's got that kind of half sneer. He'll launch your ball out of the stadium instead of throwing it to you. Like, what a guy.
he's just so much fun to watch in many aspects.
Yes. And he's undoubtedly going to make the Hall of Fame when he does retire. But as it stands right now, there is actually just one Canadian-born Hall of Famer, right-handed pitcher Fergie Jenkins, whose career spans 19 seasons from 1965 through 1983. Jenkins was a three-time All-Star who won the 1971 National League Cy Young Award for a season in which he posted a 2.77 ERA and hurled an MLB-leading 30 complete games. Larry Walker would be the next Canadian-born player in, but time is running out for him to be voted in, so... I don't know. We might have to wait for Votto.
And now our guest host, Rachel, has some other Canadian baseball fun facts they'd like to share with us. Rachel, take it away.
Thank you. I don't know actually how much fun these are. I feel like nobody probably cares about very early Canadian baseball history as much as I do. But here we go anyway. So baseball has actually been around in Canada for like pretty much as long as it's been around in the US. Like, obviously we can't trace it back to the game where it all started because things aren't that well documented. But for a time there were certain Canadian baseball historians who remain unnamed who claimed that baseball actually started in Canada, in Saskatchewan. Now, I don't think this is actually true, but that just goes to show how deep this history goes, how early Canadian baseball has happened. And in the early days of Canadian baseball, they actually played a variation on the game that had 11 players. There was a fourth baseman and there was a backup catcher. And instead of it being that the batter's side of the inning, like the side was retired when there were three outs, the side was only retired when you'd gotten through all 11 batters on the opposing team, which sounds like a nightmare for pace of play.
oh my gosh.
Yeah, that must have been like, so obviously that variation on the game was not that much fun to watch, again, because it went on forever, because you had to get through all 11 batters on the other team. So eventually the New York baseball rules, which are the rules that most closely resemble the ones that we have today, made their way across the border into Southern Ontario, and professional Canadian baseball teams actually started popping up like when American baseball leagues were solidifying. And what the International Association, when it was founded in 1877, it actually had two Canadian teams on it. And the first game between, you know, Canadian and American professional baseball clubs was actually all the way back in 1860. So that is, the more you know, Canadian baseball has been around forever, even though relative to how long the game has been in Canada and how many people have played it and how popular it was in the early days, there haven't been that many Canadian major leaguers for whatever reason. I guess Canada, like the population of Canada is less than that of California. So I guess that makes a little bit of sense, but.
Those are all things that I did not know. So I very much appreciate learning that. I didn't know that the 11 player variant was a thing. I didn't. What is a fourth baseman? Was there a fourth base, or was that just, is home fourth base? What is that?
I think he was just like an extra shortstop in essence.
All right, sure, why not?
Sometimes you need it. Sometimes you need that extra guy there.
Yeah, you know, sometimes they do that crazy shift where they have like five men on the infield. Maybe it was like that just all the time. Yeah, they have 11 guys, why not?
Yeah, the newest baseball innovation.
Oh man. So did they still play, did they still play 9 innings with having to go through all 11 batters every inning?
I mean, like nobody was really enforcing the games at that point. It was pretty loose, but technically you were supposed to play 9 innings.
Oh my.
Which is horrifying.
Oh, that is too much. Rob Manfred's just having an aneurysm thinking about this.
He's like, oh my God, pace of play. No.
Yeah. well, I hope everybody out there who observes has a happy Canada Day. Hope people are going to get their James Paxton Eagle bobbleheads if you're in Seattle, because that is one of the best promotions that I've ever seen. And after they did turn ahead the clock night, too, they're like on a roll this weekend.
They've got a really good promotions department there.
Yeah, good job, Mariners. That's not really related to Canadian baseball besides the James Paxton thing, but just wanted to throw it out there. Now, shifting focus to an American player, Jason Worth announced his retirement on Wednesday, ending a 15-year MLB career. Worth played 2 seasons with the Blue Jays and then 2 with the Dodgers to start his career before injuries forced him to miss the entire 2006 season. He came back with the Phillies in 2007, where he played for 4 years before joining the Nationals, the team with which he finished off the final 7 seasons of his career. Worth posted a very respectable career 267, 360, 455 slash line, a total of 229 home runs and 799 RBIs. What are our favorite Jason Worth memories?
The fly ball, there's a gif of him putting his hand up to catch a fly ball that is like 5 or 6 feet behind him.
Yep.
And I just think that image, that moving image, expresses something so profound about the human condition. And it is one of the greatest moving images that human history has ever produced, because he just has his hand up in the air. He's waiting so patiently. He's looking to the sky for the ball to come into his glove, and then it just falls behind him. It's tragic and it's wonderful. And I appreciate Jason Worth for giving us all that moment.
It's like a metaphor for the 2016 presidential election.
Oh, God.
I'm sorry. That got grim. that was Andre Ethier who hit that. I remember very vividly watching and just being like, oh, my God, what are you doing? And then the gif that came out of it is, like you said, a gift to all of us. I feel bad that we're kind of focusing on negative Jason Worth things, but nonetheless, you gotta mention the gif of him getting, he didn't strike out on the pitch, but he like goes into an existential crisis over a 57 mile per hour curveball that Carlos Villanueva threw him. Like, he throws in this thing, it floats in. Worth just, like, stands there, has this, like, look on his face, like he's suddenly questioning his entire life and existence. And it's just, it is one of the best baseball gifs. And, again, feel bad for, like, focusing on the negative things with him. But, you know, you just gotta respect that he, you know, he was kind of a character. He had that crazy beard and that crazy hair, and it's just such a look, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, like, he had a career 267, 360, 455 slash line, 229 home runs. Like, there are only so many times you can relive a great home run and a great hit when there are that many of them. Sometimes you just got to focus on the weird stuff, which unfortunately is often negative, but it's not negative for us watching it.
Completely agreed.
I just remember being in a minor league press box while that was happening. It was the California League playoffs, and we're just like looking at a computer screen and we're like, what just happened? And it was like, that was an easy fly ball. Why didn't he just move back? Why was he so just there? And it's like, I will never forget that moment, not just for Jason Worth's existential crisis, but also the sheer confusion in the press box at the time.
Yeah, and I mean,
he had so much faith that the ball was going to come to him. It's really like, there's just so much going on in that moment. And the scoreboard, like, flashing behind him, it's something that only a true cinematic genius would have thought up in fiction.
Yeah, I should mention Jason Worth was on the 2004 Dodgers, and that was, well, I guess I got into baseball the year before that, but that was like right at like the height of like my first kind of go around with being really into baseball. So he'll always have that for me too. I, you know, always very much remember him being part of my early baseball fandom, and I feel bad that I can't think of anything specific that happened, but I don't know. That was also before he had the beard and stuff. So I don't know. Yeah, I feel like he didn't really become Jason Worth till he had the beard. Not that he was like, he was good, but like he kind of needed like the look.
Yeah. Just kind of like, I decided to Google best Jason Worth moments. And one of the first things that came up was when Jason Worth gave Jonathan Papelbon the nickname of the DC Strangler. So I think that kind of explains Jason Worth in a nutshell. It's existential crises and nicknames about Jonathan Papelbon.
That's a fine legacy to have.
It's a great legacy. And so on the opposite side of things, not a retirement, but a return, someone else has returned to professional baseball. After 8 years away, Grant Desmay, a former top prospect selected by the A's in the second round of the 2007 draft, is now with the Lancaster Barnstormers of the Atlantic League after having left the sport in 2009 to become a priest, which is a really uncommon story. RJ Anderson at CBS Sports had the details. It's not uncommon for folks who join a seminary, to leave after they feel their time there is through. And that's essentially what happened with him. He felt the time had come for him to return to baseball. And so far, it's gone pretty well. He's put up good numbers in the short number of games that he's been playing again. And as Anderson notes, the Atlantic League is regularly scouted by major league teams. So there's a chance that he was now 30 years old, could come back in affiliated ball at some point. And so it's an unusual story you don't hear often about, first of all, top prospects leaving the sport to join the seminary, and then years later, leaving the seminary to join baseball again. But he's not the only person who left baseball before his time to pursue another life path. So excluding injury and military service, what are some of the more uncommon instances of people leaving baseball early?
So Bill Lange, who played for the Cubs in the late 19th century, retired at the age of 28 because his future father-in-law didn't want his daughter to marry a baseball player.
You'd have to think if this had happened, like, maybe even 50 years down the road, that would not like that. That would not happen. Like,
yeah,
if it happened at a point where like ball players are making real money, they'd be like, oh no, please go marry a baseball player. but yeah, that is a very late 1800s thing to happen. It feels like
maybe he just really hated the Cubs.
That could be. I mean, he'd fit right into today's society. I mean, besides, I mean, there's obviously many, many Cubs fans, but they've made their enemies. Well, this is another Cubs player. You probably remember this a few years back. Adrian Cardenas wrote a piece for The New Yorker about his decision to retire from baseball at the age of 24. He was a former first-round draft pick who had a shot at getting regular playing time with the Cubs, but found himself more invested in his off-season studies than in playing baseball. He ended up enrolled full-time at NYU, and he's now getting his MFA at NYU Film School. I should mention that I actually had a class at NYU with Adrian. It was the baseball theology seminar I took that I've mentioned a few times on here. And he, you know, we like obviously heard his story in there. And I was like, whoa, that's crazy. You were a pro baseball player, and now you're here in this class. Like, what? That's nuts. But super nice guy. Really happy for him. See him, like, on Instagram posting his like film school shooting stuff. I think he was filming stuff in Cuba for his thesis, and just seems like he's really kind of doing what he loves now. So really happy for him.
So another one that's kind of prominent, just more because he's well known for his work outside of playing, is Garrett Brushhouse. He was drafted in the fifth round of in 2004 by the Giants, and you know, he was bouncing around the minor leagues a lot, and he wrote a lot for like Baseball America and his own blog about what it's like to travel in the bus leagues, and wrote stories about like how Madison Bumgarner would just be a weird teenager saying, hey, let's go catch an opossum, which I believe is still up on Baseball America today. And he would also write for the Sporting News, and then around 2009, I guess, or 2008, he decided to retire because he realized that he wasn't getting anywhere in baseball. I think it was 2009. Yeah, he realized he was getting nowhere with baseball. He was just going to become a journeyman. So he retired and went to law school. Now he's a practicing lawyer in the St. Louis area, and he is one of the lawyers who led the case for fair wages in minor league baseball.
Good for him. I mean, that seems like a really great way to sort of marry the experience that he had with the new life path that he took. I also just want to say he has a very cute dog looking at his Twitter avatar. Which is the important thing here, clearly.
That's the real sign that you're living your best life.
I will say that he's had that same dog picture since 2009, since he was still playing. So, it's a good dog. Heading over to Detroit, Tigers pitching coach Chris Bosio was fired Wednesday for racially insensitive comments. Evidently, Bosio referred to a black clubhouse attendant as a monkey. Bosio defended himself, explaining that he was making a reference to pitcher Daniel Stumpf, who Bosio claims is nicknamed Spider Monkey due to his lanky frame and bizarre facial expressions. Though in the Detroit Free Press, Stumpf denied knowledge of such a nickname, being like, I've never been called that before. Additionally, several Tigers team sources refuted Bosio's account, claiming he actually said, like this monkey here, while gesturing to the black clubhouse attendant. Tigers manager Ron Gardenhire commented on the incident, saying, I think this has been a bit of a reality check for everybody that, hey, we're not going to stand for this anymore. We've got to get this out of our lives and treat each other with respect. This change has been going on, and it's probably overdue and needs to be pushed even harder. This is a most unfortunate occurrence, and we wish the best to the clubhouse attendant after having to go through it. However, we'd also like to give kudos to the Tigers for handling the situation properly, and also to Gardenhire for his firm stand on the issue.
Yeah, this is a really kind of awful thing that happened, and it's just kind of amazing that something like this, I mean, I guess it's not actually amazing considering everything else in the world, but, you know, you would think that people would be somewhat smarter about it if they have such a high profile job, but you know, clearly not always. So yeah, it's just nice to see like a situation where somebody who does do something like this actually gets the proper consequences for it, because that doesn't always happen. Stephanie Springer wrote a piece on Wednesday for the Hardball Times in which she discussed the shortcomings of various hiring processes in Major League Baseball when it comes to non-male individuals, a subject we are, of course, quite passionate here about at the Hardball Times Audio. Well, Stephanie is joining us now today to discuss this issue and her piece. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you've advocated for more diversity in Major League front offices before, though not necessarily in an article format. What led you to writing this piece?
Well, as I referenced in my article, Christina Carl had a great article herself about a month ago. And in the follow-up podcast, Christina was talking to Ben Lindberg and Jeff Sullivan on the Effectively Wild podcast. And she noted that with more women from STEM-related fields coming into baseball front offices, since there has been a small increase in the number of women joining front offices over the last year or two. She noted that when you're not a man in a STEM-related field, you tend to find some adversity just in terms of the gender bias and the disparity between the men and the non-men in science, technology, engineering-related fields. And she postulated that might help them in the baseball environment. And since, from my own background, I'm very interested in science education. I kind of saw those comments and kind of took a look at how the increase in diversity in STEM fields, how that might be applied to a baseball situation. And so because this is a passion of mine, just increasing diversity and representation in the sciences, I kind of figured that there could be some lessons that could be translated into baseball hiring as well.
So with the diversity fellows in the inaugural MLB Diversity Fellowship announced recently, what are your thoughts on the final selectants?
So it's a really impressive class. If you get a chance, there is MLB has linked a little bit of a bio for each of the participants, and they're really, really impressive. They all have really strong backgrounds. I think that is something that kind of makes me think, if these people are really, really so qualified, then why most of them seem to me like they would be totally qualified to have a full-time job with a baseball team or in the commissioner's office. So it's kind of, it's impressive, but it's also kind of sad that they haven't already had this opportunity with a team or with the commissioner's office, since it's a really impressive list.
Going forward, do you think that there's anything that MLB can do to increase diversity in the fellowship itself?
I think a lot of it is going to just take outreach. Kim Ng has noted several times in various interviews that there's this thought that maybe it's just that people who aren't like the stereotypical baseball fans, they just don't know that these positions exist. For instance, I think there are still a lot of people in the general public that assume that if think about when you watch a broadcast, usually there's always a former player in the booth, right? And then you kind of hear about these executives with different teams, and you typically only hear about, say, the GM. You hear about the manager. They typically have either playing experience or, obviously they're all men, and they all tend to look alike, literally and figuratively. So it's easy to think that is the only way to get in, and that there isn't any use for anything else. Anecdotally, like I said, since science is my passion, I've met some women undergraduates who are majoring in statistics and math and computer science, and they're casual sports fans. Like one in particular, I actually met her at a baseball game, and I was talking to her about Moneyball, and she hadn't watched Moneyball. She didn't know anything about the book. And when I started talking to her about these jobs in the front office, where they are actively looking for someone that has a strong background in computer science and math and statistics, she had no idea that these roles existed. So that's one part of the issue. And I think there is starting to be some awareness of that. So I think it was last summer, there's a program called Girls Who Code. They visited BAM last summer, that's Baseball Advanced Media, and they actually met with several of the women that work at BAM. Now, because these women are working behind the scenes, you don't really see them. All you see, of course, is the male face. And that's, again, we see that broadcast-wise, you see that in the upper echelons of the front office and the commissioner's office. So I think that there needs to be more awareness of the roles more generally. I think too, there has to be a better appreciation for the different backgrounds that can fit into a front office and play a role in decision making. If you look at the typical job requisition, it's very limited. It's limited to the actual degrees that you need to have before you can even apply, which, I mean, that's silly. It's a lot of the, like, let's say R, SQL, Python, some of those programming language, that's something that anybody can learn on their own. They don't necessarily have to have that specific degree. So it's kind of, it's very limiting when you're limiting it to a specific degree. You're only targeting a certain subset of the population, and you're not reaching out to specific people. So, for example, one thing I would do is obviously continue with the partnership with Girls Who Code, and hopefully they can visit every year, because I think that'll help encourage younger students to be more aware that there are these positions available. Honestly, I would like to see someone work with, say, 500 women scientists and 500 queer scientists, just to like get the word out, because there are data scientists within those groups. There are people that have more of an interest in, say, injury backgrounds and injury analytics that are within 500 women scientists and 500 queer scientists. And I think because it's been noted several times that perhaps that needs to be, like, injury prevention, let's say, and overall health of the players, that should be something that we need to reach out to those groups more. We can't just sit back and rely on people coming to baseball. And I think that just having these outreach programs could also help not only diversify the front office, but increase the fan base, since we already know that baseball is kind of suffering in that regard.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the things that, you know, I've been thinking about is how they could just, you know, reach women's colleges, historically Black colleges, and just going to the schools that are definitely like geared towards the sciences for marginalized people and people who don't necessarily have those opportunities, or like going to a STEM magnet school in an underserved area, you know, small things
exactly. Like that. Yeah, exactly. And I think there's even I feel like this could also be coupled with the RBI initiative, where it's important to make sure all kids know that they can play baseball, but at the same time, we should also remind them that there is a place for them in the baseball community, even if they can't play. And I think that this would be a good way to do that.
I agree. So on that note, realistically, when do you think we'll see more diversity in equity in front offices, not just numbers kind of trickling in here and there?
it's going to be a long time unless someone is very proactive, and it has to come from up high. So essentially the commissioner's office, they really need to be much more firm with hiring practices and outreach. For example, obviously the Rooney Rule isn't great, since there's already studies showing that if you only have one token candidate that is a non-white cis man, that statistically speaking, that person is not going to get hired. So the Selig Rule, which is generally thought of as the baseball equivalent of that, that doesn't even require you to interview someone. That just says you have to consider a diverse candidate. It doesn't say, well, how is this person diverse, and what do you consider considering? So that's a huge problem. I think much more generally, we in this country, we have a huge cultural issue where a lot of that is something that we're going to have to tackle, these heteronormative gender roles in society more generally. And I think that is something that we could attack from the baseball angle, let's say. But I think just if you look at Twitter or any comment section, you could see that there is a lot of pushback from white cis men who kind of don't want people that don't look like them invading their space. And that's a huge deterrent. And that's something that I think the commissioner's office could do a better part of addressing. I think that obviously it wouldn't be as extreme amongst internally coworkers in baseball, but I think that there is some of that bias, whether or not someone is conscious of it or not. I think I had mentioned in the story, you know, just a lot of these biases, they start from like the lower minor league. So if a player gets traded or they get their assignment to another team or another location, you'll see when someone is writing up the trade story, sometimes you'll see, oh, the player called their wife and the wife started making arrangements for them to move. I mean, that is like, I just feel like that epitomizes a lot of the problem here, where somehow like these things are happening, but the in a heteronormative gender assignment, it falls to the woman to take on some of this stuff. And so I really feel like a huge part of the problem is just society. So it's going to be a really long time.
Yeah, I agree with you that society is the biggest culprit here. Well, thank you again for coming on to talk to us. We really appreciate your thoughts on the subject. You can follow Stephanie on Twitter at Stephanie Kays. Again, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And now for this week in baseball history. On June 29th, 1990, Dave Stewart and Fernando Valenzuela both pitched no-hitters. It remains the only instance in MLB history of multiple no-hitters on the same day.
This week provided a couple of notable retirement ceremonies. First, on July 4th, 1939, the Yankees retired Lou Gehrig's number as the legendary first baseman announced his retirement from the game of baseball with his famous luckiest man on the face of the earth speech. It was the first time in MLB history that a player had his number retired. Then on July 3rd, 1994, Cleveland retired Larry Doby's number 47 years to the day after Bill Veeck purchased his contract from the Newark Eagles.
On July 5th, 1898, Lizzie Arlington became the first woman to play organized baseball, allowing two walks and one hit before recording three straight outs. Though she was slated to play in another game later that season in Hartford, their manager supposedly complained, citing unfair play, and Arlington never made another professional baseball appearance.
That's so disappointing.
Unfair play? What? All right. Gotta love that fragile masculinity.
And also on this day in baseball history, according to @ESPN Coastal, Bobby Bonilla signed a deferred money contract in 1999. So every year on July 1st from 2011 to 2035, Bobby Bonilla receives $1,193,248.20 from the New York Mets. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find the Hardball Times at fangraphs.com/THT and on Twitter at @Hardball_Times. I can be found on Twitter at @JenMacRamos. You can find Sarah at @SarahWexler32. You can find the absent Mary at Mary M. Craig. You can find Rachel at @RumHamlet. And you can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times Audio on fangraphs.com/THT/THT-audio and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.